Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web edition of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. John Schmaltzbauer. He holds the Blanche Gorman Strong Endowed Chair in Protestant Studies and is a faculty member in Religious Studies at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, John.
Oh, really good to be here.
So, John, you've written a book just recently. It just came out, as a matter of fact. What's the title, and give us a description sort of the general purpose of the book?
The Resilience of Religion in American Higher Education, co-authored with historian Kathleen Mahoney. Resilience is the word in the title that I think sums up what we're saying the best, that religion did not disappear from colleges and universities, as some predicted. There certainly was an attenuation, but there is more attention now to religion than there was just a few decades ago in many disciplines, and also a lively student religious marketplace.
Now, the interesting thing, of course, people will say this is STEM Spots, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Why in the world are we talking about this? Well, partly because many people, at least at one time, thought that the death knell for religion at the university, the secular university, the terrible secular university in many people's minds, would come at the hands of the scientists and perhaps the engineers. But that isn't necessarily so. So I'm interested, of course, in this interplay between what people thought was going to happen because of the natural world intruding upon the university and what has happened. So talk a little bit about that.
You know, that is what people thought would happen. Andrew Dixon White talked about the warfare of science and religion. And I think that Darwinian evolution and a lot of developments like that were kind of hard for some people of faith to deal with. But there are a lot of Americans who are able to hold things together quite well, maybe not entirely consistently. And universities also, I think, have been more hospitable to religion than one might think. And scientists may be far less secular, at least in their personal lives, than the image might suggest of the secular scientists doing battle against religion.
So since we now kind of have a framework, when you go out as a sociologist, what is it that you're looking for? How do you build the case? So talk about the kinds of things you went out to look at to establish this case of resiliency for religion.
Well, I think you have to sort of think about different parts of the university and what's going on and change over time. And nobody set out to do a huge experiment 25, 30 years ago. So it's not like we have a survey at time one and a survey at time two and we can compare the two necessarily. So what we kind of were doing is looking really at what people had written in different disciplines. And in many disciplines, from medical schools to history departments to philosophy, to social work, we found people saying, you know, there's more attention to religion than there has been in an awful long time. Sometimes a key article pulling all those things together, or saying, hey, we should pay more attention to religion, and maybe it's somebody who's quite influential in that field. And so we were kind of looking for things like that without trying to give in to confirmation bias. Got to make sure that when we see that there are limits to the attention span of scholars for religion, that we're aware of that too. You know, there are surveys that show that most scholars don't pay attention to religion and spirituality in their work. Indifference is probably the rule rather than any kind of hostility. But in almost every humanities and social science field, and in some of the natural sciences, there are pockets of people who are doing serious work trying to think about what does our scholarship mean for religion, or maybe what does religion mean for our scholarship?
Now, you talk to students all the time in your own classes. You must have a feel for this in some way, shape, or form. So is it possible that, let's call it the unfulfilled promise in some sense of the sciences, who, let's say, 150 years ago, perhaps promised a utopia by now and haven't delivered at all. Is it possible that people have looked at what science has delivered and are losing confidence in it, and it might play in some way, shape, or form to the renewed confidence they have in something like the spiritual approach to things? Have you seen anything like that?
Well, I know that some people have speculated that when people lost confidence in Marxism, and when people lost confidence maybe, you know, in huge economic downturns in capitalism or a free market society, that there may be a similar cynicism about technology, especially as people see some of the negative unintended consequences, you know, like the warming of the planet, which of course science also is helpful in tracking, but a lot of it is a result of the things that we've built. And so there is a quest for, well, what is the larger moral or ethical compass that we're steering all this with? How do we decide what's right to do as a society? And so I think sometimes it does raise moral questions for people.
So when you talk to students, so science, the whole pitch in science is to be dispassionate. The whole pitch is that supposedly, whether it's, you know, some sort of a physical approach or whatever you want to call it, positivism or something like that, is that there's a natural world out there waiting to be discovered, and we must, without any bias at all, try to dispassionately discover it. And it's conceivable, because I think I see this in students sometimes, that they're looking in their own lives for more passion, not less. Is that possible?
I think there are some students who question objectivity, who want more of a, instead of a disinterested approach, more of a point of view. I'm not sure they're looking for that in science.
No, I think that perhaps that might dovetail a little bit with people's increased interest in religion or spirituality in some sense. I just wonder about that sometimes. When you talk to students, do you ever get a sense that there's correlations going on, or is it just arbitrary?
Well, sometimes people are remarkably inconsistent. A student can express skepticism about, maybe even the Earth being millions of years old, but at the same time passionately defend vaccinations against the skeptics and say that that science is valid. You know, people are capable of holding together, you know, conflicting views of things. You know, of course, we're in a little bit more conservative part of the country.
Sure.
And yet we're in a university town. And so sometimes that results in some odd combinations.
So when you talked about you guys looking for increased examples of scholarship and writings and things like that amongst the academics, do you sense that the academics are talking about this dispassionately themselves? And so, in other words, they're writing more about religion and they're considering the religion more without it being directly invoked in their own lives, or is there a connection of some kind there?
Yeah, it really varies. I think there are some people who are trying to apply the tools of science to look at religious experience in a dispassionate way, to look at, you know, are there more parts of the brain that light up when you know, somebody is meditating. I guess Tibetan Buddhist monks are participating with neuroscience studies, and the Dalai Lama spoke to the neuroscientists, but he wasn't trying to make people into Buddhists necessarily. They're almost the research subjects in that case. In other situations, there may be somebody like the British physicist John Polkinghorne, who's an Anglican priest, who is not trying to, in a fundamentalist way, bring religion and science together, but at least to have some type of dialogue and to use his science to think about his religion. And of course, you probably know more about him than I would, since you're a physicist.
I've read some of his physics stuff. I haven't read much of his general general books. Well, in that case, there might be these institutions, I think you talk about them quite a bit, who are actually trying to promote this sort of activity. So talk about external influences, let's call them, nonprofits or foundations, endowments that are trying to drive this discussion. Are there people who are doing that?
Well, I would say that the three horsemen of religious philanthropy in the university would be the Pew Charitable Trusts, who have kind of gotten out of it, but were very important in the past, Lilly Endowment in Indianapolis, and the John Templeton Foundation. For people who care about science, there's no question the John Templeton Foundation is the one that really matters in terms of funding all kinds of things. They funded several hundred courses on religion and science. You could get a grant to develop a course, maybe pay for some books. They funded all kinds of research on religion and medicine, including a center at Duke Medical School, which is, you know, one of the better medical schools in the country, that sort of thing. And there's a real intense debate about, you know, whether that's a good thing for those fields. And, you know, there's even a philanthropist who calls himself the anti-Templeton, who had a conference about sort of having a more robust secularism. Now, I think the anti-Templeton doesn't have as much money as the Templeton, so they may be outmatched there. Yeah. But and Templeton itself has changed. They've moved away sometimes from things that are more controversial. They won't touch a topic like intelligent design, for example,
right,
which has been identified with, you know, more of a more strident type of creationism in the minds of a lot of scientists. Whereas Templeton will, you know, try to invite people who are even critics of what they're trying to do to conferences, science journalists and things like that. Even it's kind of a public event in New York City celebrating science at museums with lectures and things like that. So I think they have successfully brought this into the conversation.
So now let's cast ourselves out into the future, because if you had talked to people maybe in 1950 or something like that, they would have expected a particular outcome. And now that outcome seems to be perhaps different than they expected. So now 20 years from now, is the religious environment of the university different? I'm not saying that the people are necessarily more religious individually, but do you think you and I talked a little bit about who's going to be studying religion and whether that's going to change and what might bring about that change. And it might be different than scientists or empirical evidence changing people's minds as much as something else. What might that look like?
Well, enrollment in religion courses was booming prior to about 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. Things start to change. And what changes is not a huge upsurge of secularism, although the percentage of Americans with no religion graduating from high school is edging up. But it was edging up during the whole time that religion enrollments were growing. What is threatening things now is economic pragmatism, the sense that what are you going to do with that? Why would you study religion when you can do something that's more vocational, technical, even in a university? I think that that is something that we didn't necessarily anticipate. The arguments were all about the secularists are going to push religion out of the university, but it may be the pragmatists, the people that are careerist in their view of higher education. And the irony there is that it may include some of the very folks, you know, cultural conservatives who are worried about religion being pushed out of American life. Some of those people, like William Bennett, The conservative activist who's actually a philosopher, have said things like, it's not really worth majoring in philosophy anymore. It's a dead-end major for your career prospects. And he'd probably say the same thing about religion. President Obama said, why would you major in art history? And so this pragmatism, this sense that higher education is not to think about the big questions of meaning and life, the universe, and everything, but is really just to have a career waiting for you, I think that may be what's most damaging, not just to the study of religion, but to the study of poetry, to the study of ancient Greek battles, to the study of art, to the study of music, all kinds of things.
You know what's interesting about that? When I talk to students and when I think about that myself, I really feel like World War II was a turning point at some level, because before that, mostly people became educated when they had enough money to become educated. Otherwise, they probably had a job. So, for example, H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, he has a history degree, if I'm not mistaken, but he made all of his money in oil futures and drilling rights. Whereas after everybody came back and started availing themselves of the GI Bill, they went to college so they could get jobs. So didn't the beginning of the erosion of that whole notion, if you read books like you and I have done a lot, you'll read about people in the 20s who routinely would talk amongst themselves at dinner parties or something about, oh, I don't know, a Latin translation of the Bible or something like that. And it seems to me that that erosion has been going on a little longer than maybe it seems.
Yeah, I mean, there was an era of the gentleman scholar where you didn't have to have a practical result of going to college, because most people didn't go to college. Most business people didn't. Now, as far as the GI Bill and the mass democratization of higher education, where you have millions of Americans suddenly who can go to college, that cuts a couple different ways for religion. You're right. A lot of people are going into engineering or computers, the early computer industry in the 60s, say, like my father, and they're not studying religion or the humanities. But I think that the 1950s really see a huge revival of religion on campus, like the one we describe in our book now.
Right.
People, maybe it's just because church attendance peaked in the 50s, but there's some moral seriousness following the devastation of the Holocaust and Nazi Germany and a World War, and GIs coming back kind of sober about the world,
right,
that I think really flavored what was going on in the classroom in the 1950s. And also the Cold War shapes things too. And so Our adversary is defined as atheistic, communist, Stalinist, or whatever. You know, we all know, actually now, looking at Russia, that religion really never died out in Russia, but that was our perception of them. Among the people, it never died out. But that shaped things here. So, of course, there was a revival of religion. Some people said it was a mile wide and an inch deep, however, because, you know, in the 60s, a lot of those huge sanctuaries that were built for churches and synagogues and other houses of worship in the 50s emptied out.
Just out of curiosity, so somebody must have already written a gigantic book about the apparent demise and the utter resilience of religion in the former Soviet Union. Has that book been written, I presume?
Yeah, there are scholars working on that. I can't remember names right now. I know that some students of the sociologist Rodney Stark have kind of looked at religion in the former Soviet Union. Actually, there's a really good essay on the website Religion and Politics about that by Jean Zubovich, I think is the scholar's name, who is actually a Russian emigre who studies mostly American religion about the changing place of religion in Russia. And he cautions that it never really died out. And today, most Russians aren't super religious, but it has a cultural place. Of course, it also has a cultural place tied to nationalism.
It does.
And so Vladimir Putin, who came out of the KGB, after all, is Mr. Russian Orthodoxy now. And you have to doubt his sincerity about that.
Maybe. Anyway, so this fascination that we both have with this kind of thing, of course, you're a professional and I'm just a rank amateur in this, this idea that conservative peoples, let's call them, who have maybe a mindset that is also more practical might drive students out of the study and ergo out of the academy, so to speak. Is there anything that people do within your own discipline in religious studies to counter that? Do they watch it happening? Do they actively try to get students to think about this as a career field or even as a minor or something like that? How do you go about infusing students with an interest in this area?
Well, I mean, there are a couple tactics that religious studies programs, including ours, have adopted. One is to really meet the people looking for practical job options where they are. And so we have 8 courses on religion, spirituality, and health, which we talked about in a previous STEM spots.
Right.
That is really working out because nurses in training, physical therapists realize they need to understand a religiously diverse society. And, you know, 1 out of 6 beds are in Catholic hospitals. So they're maybe working in a religious institution. The other tack is really to realize that there are still students who are interested in reading old texts and old books. The C.S. Lewis course, for example, does really, really well. C.S. Lewis was a cultural conservative, but he wasn't somebody who said that Oxford University should be turned into a vo-tech. He believed in asking the big questions, and I think that's something that some students still value.
Now, was he a don at Oxford or Cambridge?
At Oxford and at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Started out at Oxford and things didn't work out so well, so he went to Cambridge late in life.
As an academic don in England at the time, it was a good gig to have. You could think about the big questions conceivably. So, John, thanks so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, and always a pleasure to hear STEM Spots on the radio.
And once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots webcast version signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.